time certain. Please read that, Carla.
Item 286, establish Public Involvement Advisory Council.
I'm happy to introduce the 3 p.m. time certain, which is a resolution to establish a Public Involvement Advisory Council. This recommendation was initiated through Bureau Innovation Project 9, in which both community members and city staff worked together to develop recommendations to create consistent public involvement procedures. If you folks could carry your conversations outside, that would be wonderful. I'd like to thank the BIP Steering Committee for their hard work, specifically the co-chairs Joanne Bowman and Eileen Argentina. Also want to thank a past member of my staff, Elizabeth Kennedy Wong, Brian Hoop from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, as well as Laurel Butman and Maja Spencer from the Office of Management and Finance. Today we bring forward one of the BIP recommendations to create a standing advisory council to consider and implement recommendations to strengthen citywide public involvement practices. The City of Portland has long demonstrated its commitment to public involvement. Each City Bureau works to create effective processes to involve the public in developing policies and decisions. Currently, there are no consistent citywide public standard, public involvement guidelines that assist each Bureau in creating clear expectations for the public. I believe that the work planned for the Public Involvement Advisory Council will strengthen the City of Portland's ability to conduct effective public involvement. In addition, it will bring opportunities for staff across City Bureaus to work collaboratively by sharing public involvement best practices and working jointly to create guidelines that strengthen their work. I'd like to turn it over to our first three presenters, Amalia Alarcon de Morris and Joanne Bowman and Eileen Argentina.
Thank you. Let's see. The Public Involvement Advisory Council is what is before you today. The Public Involvement Advisory Council is a shared partnership between the city and the community working together to create public involvement guidelines and best practices that will work from both perspectives. This shared partnership would be between the community and the government and also internally between and among bureaus. This is, as the mayor had said, something that has been recommended by the BIP 9 group, as well as the five-year plan to increase community involvement that you just heard of. Additionally, there are also other types of groups over the last 10 years that have met in the city that have recommended something like the Public Involvement Advisory Council, including the 1996 Task Force on Neighborhood Involvement. There was a city council resolution in 1996 that established a set of citizen involvement principles. There was the administrative services review effort in 2000. We had a public involvement task force that met for a year in 2003 that came up with a series of recommendations, one of which was this. Why is this group needed? Portland's citizen involvement principles that were adopted by resolution in 96 state that collaboration between city and community will result in the best policies and decisions for all of Portland, and you've heard that through the five-year plan testimony earlier as well. A standing body is needed because we have groups like BIP9 and the Public Involvement Standards Task Force that have come up with wonderful, excellent recommendations. However, an ongoing group is required to thoughtfully consider each of these recommendations, to pilot them, to get input and buy-in from bureaus and communities, to get council approval for each recommendation, and to support the application and implementation of each item and provide training if necessary. This advisory council will see the whole process through, ensuring that public involvement gets the close attention that it deserves and it requires, and will therefore create some effective and consistent guidelines that can be a long-lasting solution for everyone. With that, I will turn this over to Joanne Bowman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, City Council members. For the record, my name is Joanne Bowman, and I'm here in support of the creation of the Public Involvement Advisory Council. I was saying to Eileen, who I co-chaired Bureau Improvement Project Number 9 with, that when I started working on public involvement for the city, I had no gray hair. And that's changed significantly because that was like 6 years ago when I actually started working on city committees to improve our public involvement process. One of the things that I'm really excited about today, as per the previous presentation was, so how do you bring community members into government? This process that we're talking about now is how do you make government processes transparent so that community members truly understand how to engage and be involved in the process. And it was truly my pleasure to serve with Arlene as co-chair of the Bureau Improvement Project number 9. And I believe that this creation of the Advisory Council is a long time in coming, and we are very appreciative that you have this in front of you today. I also want to thank you for the very thoughtfulness. Many times governments, as leaders change, people change priorities. And what's exciting about being here today is watching how we build on previous efforts. And so no one's thrown out anything. What we've done is just build on work that we've done in the past over the last 10 years, as was reported. And I think that that says a lot about the leadership at the city, that we take what's working and make it better. So thank you for listening to me today.
Mayor and commissioners, good afternoon. My name is Eileen Argentina. I'm with Portland Parks and Recreation. And as Joanne mentioned, I was co-chair of BIP 9. And I also just want to congratulate you and thank you for the follow-through on Community Connect. Early on in our time, when they were still known as BIP 8, it gave us comfort to know there was a group out there with a tougher scope than what we had.
Right.
And they had it. They worked very hard on that. It's great to see it come to fruition. One of the things we figured out early on in BIP 9 was that the scope of what really needed to be done, what had been identified by the prior task force, was really huge, and it was beyond what we could accomplish. Our committee struggled with that quite a bit because we were focusing on a very finite scope of trying to get some consistent tools in place, but we knew the work was going to be there. There would always be a lot of work. So I fully support the establishment of this council, and I think it'll be very helpful. From the perspective of a manager within the city, I think that statement of support from all of you for a standing council is going to be powerful. I think it'll be a place for collaboration and coordination that Bureau staff will benefit from. There's already been an initial meeting of the Public Involvement Network at the city. There are about 40 people there, people in all kinds of classifications and roles, because all of us have this job to do now of public involvement. So I think this will be extremely helpful, and from the perspective of city staff, I think that you'll find it will really support this work. Thank you.
Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Who else is?
We're bringing Paul Leisner.
Up again.
Hello again. Paul Leisner with the Center for Public Participation at PSU. And one thing that I wanted to talk about is just the community perspective. I know that you've heard in the past that there's been frustration in the community that sometimes the community there will be a process where it's well designed and runs very well and people are very happy with it. Other times, as many of you have experienced, it doesn't work so well. There isn't consistency from bureau to bureau of how involvement is done and from project manager to project manager within bureaus. And part of it is, I think this is the compassionate approach that's being taken with this council here. It's not to beat public employees over the head, but to really try to create a partnership between community members and public employees to work together to figure out how can we help them do the kind of engagement that feels good and is successful and do it in a positive way. I think having worked in the public sector as well, I know what it's like to go out there and have people scream at you and what you're standing there as the process falls apart around you and you know that it's going badly, but you have no idea how to get out. And I think that lots of times we send our employees out there without the proper training and background and support to really do it in a positive way. So no wonder oftentimes they're reluctant to do it. And sometimes the public perceives them as not wanting that input or not valuing the community input. So I think for the first time by creating this council, you're creating a focus, as I think as Joanne and Eileen said, an ongoing focus that this is something important to do. We're here to empower and help our public employees to be the other side of Community Connect, create capacity in the community, and create willingness and ability within city government to actually be in the kind of partnership that I think Mayor Potter has set as a goal for our city. The shared governance model requires that both sides be able to do it and to feel good doing it. And I think by approving this council, you will be helping us give a long-term focus to providing that sort of assistance and making that change. Thank you.
We have a sign-up sheet.
Yes, we have three people signed up. Kathleen Todd, Sandra, I believe it's Le Freneros, and C.C. Hughley-Knoll. Sorry.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, state your name for the record. Each have 2 minutes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Kathleen Todd. I am the Director of the Office of Citizen Involvement for Multnomah County. My office supplies staff support for the county's Citizen Involvement Committee. My career in citizen involvement spans nearly 30 years, all of which has been connected to citizen involvement in government in some fashion. Over that time, I have noticed that there are some general categories or stages one could assign to public involvement in government. Citizen involvement is either prohibited, discouraged, ignored, tolerated, or sought out and valued. A tangible way to show that Portland city government has moved squarely into the sought out and valued category is to support the creation of this council. Institutionalizing the mechanisms that make citizen participation easier is a good thing. Institutionalizing mechanisms goes far beyond public testimony and public hearings. The makeup of this council is a partnership which will assist you in creating a specific internal culture among departments, decision makers, and the community, a culture that demonstrates the need for and desire to include everyone in all aspects of the decision-making process. The legacy will be a roadmap that will be in place and stay in place through change in city leadership. I encourage you to strengthen your citizen involvement process by creating this internal environment where collaboration is expected and just plain part of how your decisions are made. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor and City Council. I'm Sandra LeFrancois, and I'm with Central Northeast Neighbors, and I was on a member of BIP number 9, Public Involvement Team, and I kindly ask you to support the continuation of this valuable effort with the establishment of a Public Involvement Advisory Council. This council will foster a needed forum for community members and city staff to work collaboratively and focus on public involvement best practices by city bureaus. Working in the community, increasingly with underrepresented groups and with neighborhoods, I can't stress enough, the importance of public involvement on the outcomes of a project and the community. This is the key to community and city relations. Currently, there is no such forum which enables community members to know what to expect when change occurs. How will they be impacted? How their voices will be heard? How their views will be considered? And how, when will they be involved and informed, and at what level? Please support the establishment of a shared city community advisory council to ensure the community is involved in ways to promote sound decisions that impact their lives in the community. And this is the key to empowerment, community governments, and long-term sustainability of our city. Thank you.
Hello again. I'm Cece Hughley-Noel, Executive Director of Southeast Uplift and Chair of Community Connect, and I'm here to support the development of the Public Involvement Advisory Council, partly because it's one of the strategies that has been moved forward with Community Connects. It's strategy number 11 in the first year. And the working group had extensive discussions about the strategies that came forward from the Public Involvement Task Force from a few years ago, talked in a lot of detail about what it would take to really support goal number 3, which is providing support for government bureaus and city elected officials to respond to that increased capacity of more and better informed citizens that are involved in this process. So we really want to encourage you to move forward with institutionalizing this process and accept the council and provide some capacity building support for city staffers. And I guess I can also say that I wish this was around when I was a city staffer doing public involvement. It would have been extremely helpful to have that level of support. The council will provide a lot of transparency in the process, eliminate a lot of redundancies in the processes that happen, eliminate a lot of confusion about what goes out to the community, and really provide a lot of cohesion for these processes that will really result in better processes and more effective solutions and problem solving, and in really engender a lot of trust and sort of dispel some of the cynicism that we have on the community side when it comes to these processes. So I encourage you to institutionalize this council. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all who signed up.
Okay. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Well, I'd like to make a request of the soon-to-be impaneled Public Involvement Advisory Council, and that is if you could use the Public Involvement Task Force to come up with an annual calendar of what the bureaus think their major public outreach needs will be or their public outreach processes will be, not to limit spur of the moment outreach, but just to, it might help to coordinate amongst the bureaus. And I think it might be an assistant. It is a complaint that I've heard from the neighborhood side that, you know, that they get hit, 1 month they get hit with three different bureaus sort of public outreach efforts. So let's start baby steps and maybe just put the calendar together and see what natural conversations flow from that. So I think this is great. I want to thank you all for your great work. Aye.
Saltzman.
I also think this is good and look forward to supporting it. And I wanted to thank Eileen Argentina and Joanne Bauman for their capable co-chairing of this BIP9 and delivering it. So thanks a lot. Aye.
Stan?
I agree. I think this could make a real difference. Good work. Aye.
Potter.
And, you know, as we talked about how to engage community, the obvious question came up as, well, what about from the city side? How do we engage? And there's some consistency between city bureaus. And the result of that is this Public Involvement Advisory Council, a forum and mechanism to make sure that as we energize citizens and empower, they empower themselves to move forward, that there's a receptive vessel here at the city that you can communicate with and collaborate with. So I would really like to thank Joanne and Eileen for their hard work and all of the folks who've been involved in this. I look forward to working with you and making our city a better place. I vote aye. Thank you very much, folks. Please read the 330 time certain.
Item 287, accept City of Portland Asset Status and Conditions Report, December 2007, from City Asset Managers Group. Mayor, they'd also like 288 read.
Yes.
Okay. Accept report on the fiscal year 2008-09 general fund capital set aside risk recommendation.
Who's going to begin?
Ready for the next one? I guess
we're
I'll
ready.
Do that. Okay. Good afternoon, Mayor Potter, members of the council. Gil Kelly, Director of Planning, and with me, of course, are Ken Rust, the Chief Administrative Officer for the city, and Bob Glasscock, who's a Senior Planner with the Bureau of Planning and the convener of the Interbureau Asset Management Group that has put together the report we have furnished you today. I'm just going to make a couple of brief remarks and then turn it over to Ken. My remarks are really about the context for this report and some of its salient features that we're continuing to work on and improve each year. On behalf of the Planning and Development Directors, we want to recommend to you the 2007 Asset Status Condition and Conditions Report. This is the fifth annual report that we've provided you since we began this. We are also bringing to you recommendations which were developed by the Interbureau Group and endorsed by the Bureau Directors Group for the General Fund Capital Set-Aside program for the coming fiscal year. That total is $1.9 million, compared to the $2.1 billion that is examined in the overall report. As you were, at least three of you will remember, about 6 years ago, we had a strategic planning session with the City Council, and you identified at the time building and maintaining the city's infrastructure as one of five key focus areas that you really wanted us to focus on for long-term planning and budgeting. And in the intervening years, you assigned the Planning and Development Directors Group to develop a systematic approach to that. We, in turn, have really commissioned the group that Bob Glasscock is here to report on to do that work. It's an interbureau group, again, consisting of the Capital Bureaus, OMF, and Planning, to devise a new approach to the accountability and the planning and budgeting for the city's capital systems, with the notion that we have to have a better approach to approaching our deteriorating citywide infrastructure. That approach has used the best practices of asset management learned in many ways from the Australian model and developed here. So, again, this is the fifth year. The key components of our approach, and one of the reasons the planning and development directors are enthusiastic about this, is that it takes the whole of the city approach. It's not simply a one bureau coming to you each at a time. We're looking across all the bureaus. We have developed a common language and common philosophy about asset management, and we have improved our collective confidence levels in the information that's been given to you, and each year that we come to you, that confidence has been raised. I remember, frankly, Commissioner Sten telling us a few years back he just frankly didn't believe our numbers, and he probably had good reason to at that point. We heeded that stern advice and really have done a lot of work in the intervening years to improve it. So we have much higher confidence levels in our inventory of what the city owns and manages, of what condition that inventory is, and our confidence levels vary from asset group to asset group, and we report that in detail. We have a much better approximation of the current replacement value of all of our assets, and again, that's the $2.1 billion figure. And we have a much better sense of what our annual funding gap is. And I know Commissioner Adams and others have been struggling to find ways to narrow that gap. Out of a $2.1 billion asset base, we have roughly a 21 billion. Sorry, move the decimal point there conveniently. Well,
maybe a sale overnight.
Yeah. We've privatized the entire transportation system. We have about somewhere between $93 and $130 million annual funding gap just to maintain the current system we have. and that range includes, as Bob will describe in more detail, includes a bump if we respond effectively to the mandate for the water system on the LT2 proposal. So that doesn't cover all of the potential gap. We're still discovering what we do. We know we have other mandates we need to address, and that will make that figure go up even further. Another key component that we have as directors looked at is a rather inclusive definition of what the city's assets are. So you'll remember we added housing, publicly owned housing and financed housing a couple of years back. We have always included from the beginning public buildings and our confidence about the conditions of those buildings and public infrastructure assets has grown. And for this year, we've also added the notion of green infrastructure, and Bob will talk about that. That has implications going forward for really counting the city's natural systems, the functioning natural systems, as an infrastructure asset in many ways, and promoting examination of a green alternative to a gray alternative in looking at new infrastructure or replacement of existing infrastructure. And I know, again, in Commissioner Adams' case, that's a work that he's doing with the Bureau of Environmental Services and Transportation. So we see that issue growing in the coming years and becoming more specific and more refined. I just wanted to mention, too, that the Portland plan, which we've mentioned in front of you today already a couple of times, will need to examine the growth here. We have talked about primarily this year and in past years and what's needed to just maintain our current deteriorating structure. We're beginning to edge in this year into what it would take to respond to state and federal mandates, code compliance. The third level, which we haven't really approached yet, is what will it take for us to respond to very robust population and job growth that we see over the next 30 years. And really the Portland plan is the place to do that, as well as to examine some alternative strategies with Ken's help in particular about how we really begin to close a widening gap that we see in the future if we just do the status quo. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ken, who's going to talk about some of the financial aspects of this and funding aspects of this, and then Bob will present you the report. Thank you.
Thanks, Gil. I'm Ken Rust, Chief Administrative Officer, and I think Gil's done a good job of summarizing the report. It's kind of a good news, bad news story. The good news is that after 5 or 6 years of doing this, we have a lot better information in the common language that Gil talked about. The bad news is that our funding gap seems to be growing, and that suggests that we have a lot of work to do if we're going to protect the infrastructure investment that we have and to make sure that we get the value out of it. There's no single magic bullet that's going to cure the problem. It's going to take a concerted effort on multiple fronts. Clearly, we're going to have to spend more money on infrastructure. We're going to have to be creative about how we find ways to do that. And I think one of the values of the asset management philosophy is trying to find ways in which we actually make the best informed decisions about the resources we're going to expend so that we get the most value out of the assets that we're investing in, and that we minimize the risk associated with the operation and maintenance of those investments. And one of the really interesting things that we're doing in the work now that the asset management group is turning to is, now that we've got a good inventory, we have confidence and reliability in that inventory, we understand the funding gap, now we're starting to move into how do we really measure risk of are the assets that we own, and how do we use that risk information to prioritize investments so that when we're spending money, even if we aren't able to fully fund all of our capital needs, we know that we're making investments in the things that are most critical and that have the highest potential for disruption to lives, to the economic vitality of the community, so that we know that the most value is being created for our assets. And one of the things you're going to hear a little bit more about today is in the kind of a test run of this risk strategy and measuring risk and a way to prioritize assets is we're doing that with the capital set aside. And there's a way and a methodology that's been created that looks at the probability of failure and the cost of failure of the different assets that we're looking at. And I think we had a very robust discussion about this with planning and development directors. I think it's still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. But my experience working for the city, you know, as dating back to 1993 during the capital budget is we've often used very subjective data to evaluate the set-aside projects in particular, which is sort of our guinea pig this year. And that's been helpful, but it really hasn't gotten to the issue of what's the consequence of the assets that we're investing in and which ones produce the biggest bang for the buck. And this has really been the work that we're now turning towards, is to get into the higher, you know, analytical pieces of asset management to make better informed decision, to prioritize our investments, and to come up with a strategy that produces long-run lower costs, knowing that that's the kind of thinking that's going to have to go into the planning that we do to make sure that we get the value out of our assets, and recognizing that we're not always going to have enough money to do all the things that we would like to do. So it's really quite exciting work. It is a work in progress. But the fact that we're doing this, when I talk to my peers around the country, not many cities are pushing it as far as we are and trying to really embrace kind of international standards, which are really leading the way in asset management and bringing that thinking and philosophy to the United States. And so it's really, really interesting, exciting work. We've done a lot of good work to get to this point, and now we're getting to the to the really the meat and the potatoes of how do we create value out of the assets in the decisions that we're making. So again, it's a continuous work in progress, and we're going to have to continue to use that thinking to make sure that we get good decisions made and that we maximize the value of the $21.5 billion worth of assets that serve our citizens every day. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bob.
Can I ask a quick clarifying question, Ken?
Sure.
So the proposed list of capital projects, was that list derived from only general fund projects or from all fund projects?
On the capital set aside, those are the capital set aside projects that went through.
Right. Was the list that you used, the raw list that you then prioritized, was it limited to projects that were only general fund?
I believe it was only projects coming to the general fund for capital set aside funding support.
So it does not include BES, water, or transportation?
No. And that's something, though, that as we develop this risk scheme, if you will.
The guy behind you. Yeah. Stalking you.
Getting nervous.
Got the cane.
Commissioner Adams, it didn't include the enterprise funds, BES, and water. It did include the requests for general fund capital support from transportation.
Right. I just, because I got some feedback from the public, how come I didn't put PDOT requests into that? And that's, we have made PDOT requests to the general fund. Mm-hmm. That particular process excludes the enterprise funds.
Right. And a couple of those PDOT projects are included in our recommendations.
I just wanted to mention, too, before Bob begins, that we do have a study group here from Federal Highway Administration and EPA and some consultants with them who have been here a couple of days now, been interviewing various bureaus and ourselves, and are looking at Portland as one of five or six case studies they're studying around the nation for, we're hesitant to say best practices, but at least for current practice. Thanks, Bob.
I'm Bob Glasscock with the Planning Bureau, and it's my pleasure to, one of my roles in coordinating infrastructure is to serve as convener of the City Asset Managers Group. So the first report that before you is our 2007 report, and I'll kind of quickly run through the highlights of that and then turn it over to Casey Short to present the general fund capital set-aside recommendations. So just a reminder, we're looking at six infrastructure groups, and for the second year, we've carried through with affordable housing as one of those six. Our core goal is to develop a sustainable asset base that responds to the triad of social, economic, and environmental needs. And as been mentioned, this year, financial planning asked our group to participate in the capital set-aside process, revise the criteria, and then bring forward a list of ranked projects. Stepping back a little bit, we're looking in the next couple of years, we'll be bringing forward the Portland plan. As part of that, there will be an update of the city's public facilities plan. We're calling it the citywide systems plan. And some asset management elements will be updating service levels, engaging the public in what levels of service they would like and are willing to pay. On the budgeting side, we'll have two funding scenarios, one with predictable revenues and the second with what we call a priority scenario. If we had more resources, what strategic improvements could we make to make a more livable community? And as Gil alluded to, we started our work in response to some goal setting in 2002 with the council and the directors group at aging infrastructure. We're moving into accounting for the known mandates, and as we move up the bars, we'll be also addressing new growth increment, and that's all three levels will be addressed as part of the Portland plan. As in prior years, we have three key measures: the replacement value, the condition, and the annual funding gap or unmet need. And with this year on the condition side, we've now gone to five levels. We started with three levels of physical condition, and we have enough information that we can break it out into five levels, and we think that will be a good planning tool for as we evaluate the projects in the future. And then we also, as has been mentioned, responded to a very constructive comment from Commissioner Sten and placed confidence levels to all of our data points. So the first major measure is the replacement value. And this year, the assets rose about $2.4 billion in value to a total of $21.5 billion. We attribute this to the addition of some new assets and improved valuation data, as well as the normal inflationary factors. Transportation assets rose about $1 billion in value, due largely to the added value of streetcar and aerial tram. Water reported a similar increase due to improved information gathered through the distribution system master plan. And they also indicate higher confidence level now that they have that master plan completed. In the civic category, there is an increase now that we're accounting for the Performing Arts Center. Oops. Go back. On the current condition side, you'll see in the green bars on top those assets that are in the best condition. And then the red bars on the bottom are in the poorest condition. There's also a large gray bar you'll see associated with PDOT, and that is a to be determined. This year, PDOT did not post the condition of the pavement, and that's because they're switching over to new software, and they're reserving the condition rating until they can get that software up and running. The percentage of bridges in good condition has also dropped from last year. In the civic group, city archives and police property warehouse will move out of poor condition, and those are as a result of projects that the council has funded. On the funding gap or unmet need side, the funding gaps for transportation, parks, and affordable housing have not changed much over last year. BES reports a slightly higher gap. The gap for civic facilities has increased as a reflection of annualizing some one-time costs, and this is a part of this continuous process of improving our way of doing business and making sure that our reporting is consistent. So again, for Civic, they've annualized the unmet needs that they otherwise would have projected as expected projects to be implemented. A note on water, has been mentioned, the baseline water funding gap of about $15 million has decreased since the 2006 report, but the LT2 mandate may require the city to replace uncovered finished storage reservoirs in their terminal supply system at Tabor and Washington Park, as well as a possible addition of a treatment at Bull Run Supply. We show that the new LT2 mandate as a dollar range. It may add $20 to $50 million a year over a 10-year period of time. With LT2, the water system gap could outstrip transportation for the largest funding gap. And I know there's not a run to compete for the largest gap, but that's just the way it works. This slide tries to put into perspective the gap each bureau faces in relation to their total budget. Now, again, their total budget is not just capital, but operations and maintenance. You'll see that on the water side, there's some dashed lines that reflects the unknowns for the extent of the cost to address the LT2 rule. Gil mentioned that this year we took on the challenge of providing a framework for green infrastructure. There were a number of conversations that we heard, green streets and street canopy and all that, and we decided to bring parties together and really come up with a common framework that could be useful for all kinds of situations and projects. So you'll see that on one side, there are projects that are more engineered, traditional engineered, or more natural. And then on the top bar, you see they vary in ownership, whereas in some cases, the city owns and manages those resources. In some cases, there are city and community partnerships. In other cases, the city actually doesn't have a direct role, and those are community assets. But it's important to track and to consider all of those. This is a kind of a conceptual picture of the risk management approach that we engaged in, we started to look at. It's as we started to expand our scope. And risk management minimizes potential failures through risk awareness and proactive management. It can be used to help set and evaluate level of service standards based on relative risk, tolerance, and willingness to pay, and can be applied both at strategic and operational levels and to specific projects. The risk management process can be used to identify and evaluate risk to the city's infrastructure. The process involves identifying, understanding, and responding to risk, recognizing community priorities, and ongoing monitoring. The basic formula to calculate asset risk is to multiply the consequence of asset failure by the likelihood of that failure. Any number of internal and external drivers can cause an asset to fail. They range from natural events and deterioration, unplanned events, et cetera. When rating the risk of an asset, it's important to evaluate these various failure modes, and that's a term we'll be hearing more about. If an asset fails, a number of consequences may occur. On the left side of the matrix, you'll see a range of consequence tiers with corresponding numerical values. Each possible consequence within a tier is considered equally. A tier 5 consequence, the most severe, includes multiple fatalities, disruption of critical services, more than $10 million in damages, etc. Consequences become less severe in the lower tiers, tiers 1 through 4. Then if you follow on the bottom of the matrix, you'll see likelihood tiers that correspond to how often those failures might occur, ranging from 5 or fewer years on up to more than 50 years. Each likelihood has a corresponding value of 1 to 5. And then when we multiply the consequence tier by the likelihood tier, we get a numerical risk rating and the corresponding relative risk, low, medium, high, or extreme. These levels of relative risk relate to the type of recommended action. For example, extreme risk assets warrant immediate action to reduce risk, while low risk assets should be managed by routine procedures. The report, the asset report, scored 7 risk examples shown here, and I'll step through the top one, the Southwest Carolina pump main. So again, before I go to that slide, you'll note that that these risk examples extend across our asset base, and in one case, we give the example of Northwest Thurman Street Bridge and Water Pipe. It's an example where the failure of either of those might cause cross failures, and so there are kind of additive consequences of one element failing. So this depicts the Southwest Carolina pump main, which is located under I-5 in Southwest Portland. The steel main lacks cathodic protection, and a leak was found in a nearby section. If the Southwest Carolina main failed, it could potentially cause I-5 to fail, causing millions of dollars of damage, possibly some loss of life, and disrupt a key transportation route. And in the red box, you'll see that we've assigned a consequence of 5. The circle on the right, on the top, of a consequence rating of 5. When we look at how the likelihood, it's not that likely that the pipe failure would bring down I-5. So it would be once every 50 years. So the combined score is a 10. So that star on the top where you see number 10 is the failure of I-5. A second failure mode might be that the pipe itself fails. And going through that same process, we have a consequence of 4, the second tier down on the left. And then on the bottom, we follow the likelihood of it being in the 3 category for a combined score of 12. So in this case, when you compare the relative risks of those two failure modes, we identify that the failure of the pipe actually had a higher risk rating, even though, because it's more likely to occur. And the Water Bureau reports that since they've gathered this information, they've gone back and done some more study, and they've determined that actually the likelihood of the pipe breaking might be less, so it might slide to further to the left, and that it's not as high a risk as they had seen, had thought with the information they had at the time. So I would like to now turn it over to Casey Short to go through the general fund capital set-aside process, and then I'll follow up with some final recommendations.
Thank you, Bob. Casey Short, financial planning manager. Last year in the infrastructure budget team meetings, we discussed the capital set-aside briefly. Financial planning made its recommendations. I made a comment there that I would be interested in bringing to the council next year, the one that we're just starting on the budget process for, perhaps an increase in the capital set aside to start to address some of the pressing infrastructure maintenance needs that the city faces that are supported by the general fund. And the council, the comment I specifically remember was from Commissioner Sten, was we would like to see more of an asset management-based approach to this rather than just somewhat arbitrarily increasing the amount of the capital set aside. I took that input, went to the capital asset managers group and said, can you help me do this, to apply the risk mitigation and capital asset management principles that you folks have been working on specifically to the general fund and specifically to those assets that are requested for repair and maintenance in the general fund set aside, which is a pretty small amount of $1.9 million. And so in working through the overall risk assessment criteria and matrix that Bob has been describing, we applied those criteria to the request for funding that had come come in through the budget process and had been submitted for consideration in the capital set-aside process. Rather than follow the old process we'd been using, which was convene the Capital Review Committee and have financial planning ultimately come up with our recommendations on what to put in the capital set aside. We went through the Capital Asset Managers Group, and we've developed the scale you'll see on one of these slides in here, there are 13 projects recommended for funding in the capital set aside. This is a significant change from prior years. We look back the last 6 or 7 years, and I noticed that only somewhere between two and five projects had been funded with the $2 million or so in capital set aside over those last few years. The bias, if you will, in the structure that we've been working with this year tended to favor higher risk but lower cost projects. So the recommendation that's coming forward to you this year is a departure from prior years. We're recommending 13 relatively small projects that can get done rather than two or three or four somewhat larger projects. That's something.
Why is that, Casey?
It's because of the way the ranking process worked in approaching it as value for bang for the buck. Can you get a project done that is a high or extreme risk project in the coming year with the limited amount of dollars that are available? Again, this is applied for this exercise only to the capital set aside, only for this $1.9 million. This is not to say that other projects like replacement of the 800 megahertz system are not probably more important to do than some of these projects, but that is a multi-million dollar, multi-year project as opposed to a contained, relatively cheap, can get done in 1 year or a few months. This is, as I said, it's a departure. I wanted to raise this for the council to consider that you may not like this approach of having a number of smaller projects. The list is in your packet. It's in slide number 17, and it's also in the full report.
I didn't get the slides printed out.
Sorry. I can give you mine or. And this will come back to council in the course of the budget process as to those projects that are included in the capital set-aside recommendations. It does range, I think, four bureaus are involved, Parks, PDOT, Fire, and OMF have projects in this list. As Ken noted, this is a work in progress. I think one of the things we need to do if we're going to pursue this approach for the general fund piece and the capital set-aside piece in future years is have our criteria prepared when the bureaus are putting their budgets and their capital requests together. We didn't get that going because we didn't start it until into the fiscal year and didn't get it ready until after the bureaus had already submitted their budgets. I'd like to have a full year cycle to go through this, refine some of the criteria. I think we'll have a better product next year, but I'm encouraged by the progress that we've made trying to gauge some of these projects or gauge all of these requests for capital fund or general fund capital money against a risk-based and an asset management approach. So with that, I've exhausted the things I had to say. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Adams? Well, I think, and I apologize, I have a prior commitment I'm going to have to leave for soon, but I just want to acknowledge and thank you for the significant leap forward on this. It's great. I just wanted to clarify, you said PCPA was included under the Civic. I didn't see PCPA show up in the line items. Somebody said that, I thought, or I misheard.
It's included in the annual report, yes. So we tracked the value, the condition, and the gap figures.
I didn't see it on the little bar charts, but again, maybe I missed it.
Buried.
Is it under spectator facilities?
It's in civic. I think it's
civic. Civic. And
I'm looking at page 19 of 59, and I see police, office buildings. Is it other buildings? Is that what it is?
Well, there's a PCPA at the far right.
Okay, based on my if you're looking at page 13.
Oh, the dotted blank one. Okay.
If you're looking at page 13 of the 07 asset report. Under civic facilities, and the last sub item is Portland Center for Performing Arts.
Okay.
And we track that through value, condition, and gap.
And it's low because we haven't done any investigation of it, or is it just our best guess?
Yeah, the low ranking here.
Okay.
The confidence level in the information, apparently, right. We haven't done.
So that's useful. Is it possible for you to also report on trends relative trends of assets moving in the, asset conditions moving in the positive direction versus the negative direction.
In physical condition or in terms of the confidence in those the data?
I got the report that we track confidence, but can we track physical condition?
Physical condition. We can flag that.
Asset group or something.
Okay.
And this is really, I'm trying to get a sense of we've made, the voters have passed a number of operating levies and geo bond levies for parks. And I'm curious if we've seen the kinds of positive results in that area.
Okay.
I think it's important to report to voters that when they decide to tax themselves, that we are producing the kind of positive results that we said. The others, I thought, Gil, your the work you're doing on with the Portland plan is really important in terms of asset new asset demands, because in effect, maintenance gap plus unmet asset demand is an even bigger gap.
Right.
And then if the group could, if they haven't already, and maybe that's we can learn something from this, these folks observing us as best practices relating to closing the gap. And if there's probably no generic across assets, types of assets to do that, but if there's best practices in particular kinds of assets to close the gap, and recommendations from the group on what we should be doing.
Sam, if I could just say one thing about that. The other step in there is to examine our service level expectations. So those could change, which may have an effect on the gap one way or the other. And that's part of the work we'll be doing in the Portland plan as well, which is a real community conversation about are you willing to live with a different kind of street or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, and with the resources that we have in transportation, we're prioritizing arterials and not neighborhood streets, not the residential neighborhood streets. We don't know what else, and that's our best way forward. So thank you for your good work.
I could cover the summary of key findings and recommendations if you'd like, or I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Any further questions?
Okay.
Eric is quiet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks. Excellent presentation.
Does it pass the Sten test this time?
Yeah, it's real
oh,
waiting.
Oh, you're going to call. Okay.
Okay, we'll go back to 287. Report, I need a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Well, this is once again, it's really great work, and I'm pleased to see affordable housing added in the green infrastructure, and I really like it's getting better each year. So, unfortunately, our gap isn't getting any better, but this our handle on the things really is. So, bye.
Sten.
So I would thank the whole team. It's really terrific work, and it certainly does pass whatever test I set up. But for those of you who they weren't at that meeting, we essentially, each budget year we're presented in good faith, I would say, by each bureau their own estimate of what their gap was. And, I think that when you're looking at your own issue, it looks like the most important thing, and it is, because if you're the water director, the gap on the water bureau's spending and the potential to have a main go out is the most important thing. That's what the water director is paid to do. But I felt like as a council member, I was having a hard time comparing apples to apples. And I also was not sure that my definition, which maybe was similar to a council definition of urgent, was the same. And so, while I wanted to support the notion that we ought to invest in our infrastructure first, I was finding if I just accepted those conclusions, it meant I invested in that infrastructure first and last because all of the money was sort of gone and it couldn't be prioritized. And I think this is just wonderful. I think this is, this shouldn't be cutting edge in terms of how cities view their assets, but it really is. And I think it's a tremendous tool that we can use. And so I do have a lot higher level of confidence. And I also think it's also, aside from budgeting, I think it's really important to have this kind of information available to citizens, because I don't think people realize how much the assets they've been investing in year after year after year are worth, how well they are taken care of comparatively. And also, I think, when we go out to voters for various measures and other things, this will allow them to make, I think, some informed choices. And we're blessed in Portland in that if things are well explained and truly needed, our voters, knock on wood, hopefully I'm not jinxing anything, almost always past things, and I think this is another way of earning that confidence. So it's great work, and I also think like sometimes you can take some of the stuff to a level of absurdity, you know. And you guys have hit the nice mark of taking something that was not, I think, well enough documented and not enough.